Engage for Success Radio, raising the profile of employee engagement and shining a light on good practice for people who believe there's a better way to work.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to show number 226 from Engage for Success. I'm host for today's show. I'm Jo Moffat. And for those who don't know who I am, I'm managing director of the specialist advertising agency Woodread. And we work with clients across a whole range of sectors, really, to help them use their brand to create the sort of emotional engagement with their people that drives effective and successful cultures inside their organisations. I'm very, very pleased to welcome as today's guest, Matt Corbishley. Matt is Director of HR and Support Services at Ashgate Hospice Care. And we're going to be talking for the next half an hour or so about particularly engaging and connecting across the hospice sector, obviously a very specialist sector within the NHS, and one that, given our demographics and what's going to come kind of coming around the corner, is going to be increasingly important in future years as well. So we're going to be talking about that for the next 30 minutes. So welcome to the show, Matt.
Hi, Jo. Nice to be with you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us. So, as I say, we're going to be speaking specifically about the hospice sector. Is that a sector that you've always worked in? I wonder whether perhaps before we get into the specifics, you can just give us a little bit of a potted biography of you and where you've come from professionally.
Sure. Yeah, so I've worked in HR for nearly 20 years now. Before that, I worked for a brief period in financial services sector, but really quite quickly decided that that wasn't a good culture fit for me.
We won't hold that against you, Matt, don't worry.
So I moved on. Actually, the company I was working for at the time allowed me to make a sidestep into HR and to do some job shadowing, I've never looked back, really. So most of my time spent in the public sector. I've done a little bit of consultancy work in the third sector, but actually until 2013, I'd never been into a hospice. I had no idea really what services a hospice provided, and I probably would have assumed something like, you know, when you're at the end of life from cancer, typically it's somewhere you go and you die, and that's it. It's fair to say in the 4 years I've been here, I've had my eyes opened a lot. That fantastic place is full of life, actually. So I feel very privileged to work where I do at the moment.
Right. Yes, we have one. But my business is based in Kent and near Tunbridge Wells, and we have one in Tunbridge Wells called Hospice in the Weald, which has really embedded itself in the local community enormously in the years since it's been in existence, actually. So I think when you say there's a lot more to them than just somewhere where people go to end their life, do you mean in terms of their relationship with the communities where they operate, or in terms of services?
Absolutely.
They offer?
I think fundamentally in terms of the services we offer. So I will just pick up on something you mentioned at the beginning, which is I think you mentioned the NHS. There are around 220 hospices, the vast majority of those, by far and away, are independent. So many of them, such as Ashgate Hospice Care, we rely on a percentage of funding from the NHS, but actually the vast majority, and in our case probably close to 80%, is through income generation and fundraising. So we've got a £1 million business. We've got 16 shops that we operate on a totally commercial independent basis. But as I said, in terms of the actual clinical services we offer, one of the stats that I was surprised by was around 50% of patients who are admitted to our inpatient units, our ward, are discharged again. So there's a huge amount of myth busting to do, I think, still in the sector. And this notion that hospices are kind of dark, sad places where you come and die couldn't actually be further from the truth.
Oh, I see. Well, no, I have to say that's not something I'd appreciated either. And so is that sort of what you call respite care? I mean, is it still people that are terminally ill, or may it not even be that?
It, It is. So it is about palliative and end of life care. But we hold outpatient clinics here for a condition called lymphedema, which I'm sure many of your listeners will know about. So where there's extreme swelling from fluid in limbs, mm-hmm. we've got the only specialist team in North Derbyshire who can help patients with that condition and control that. We've also got a day hospice, so that's mm-hmm. daycare for 16 or 17 people, right. and a huge amount of work. Probably the bulk of the work goes on in the community, actually, and that's what we're focused on at the moment. We've just mm-hmm. launched something called our Big Ambition, which is about generating additional revenue, regular giving, to enable us to provide care for people at home. So we know in the community, there's around 1 in 4 people who need hospice care at home aren't able to get it at the moment, so we've got a big push around that community work.
So they can't get it because there is only limited number of places and beds and resources available. It's a lack of service availability, is it, that one
it, it is, yeah, and increasingly we're conscious of people's choice, so lots of people don't want to die in hospital. Equally, some people don't want to die in a hospice, as great as the care is. Lots of people want to be at home with their loved ones. We have got teams who can support people to do that, but there's not enough of them. So at the moment, we only provide that service Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, and what we're seeking to do is to raise additional funds so that we can make that a 24/7 service.
Sure. So I guess, you're talking about the vast majority of what you're needing to raise is actually comes from your own fundraising.
Absolutely.
It is an incredibly expensive service to deliver, I guess, isn't it? When you start talking 24/7, one-on-one, sometimes personal care, this does not come cheaply, does it?
Absolutely not. We're probably looking at the need for another £500,000 a year to get to the staffing levels that we would like to get to start to tackle that unmet need, as we refer to it as. So.
And is that something that you're not alone as a hospice facing? Is that systemic across the whole sector, that everybody is struggling?
It is. And I suppose this leads us into why we're looking at the strategic HR network. So you probably heard that people are living longer. That's a fact that's kind of booted around quite a lot in the media. The reality is that because people are living longer, they have more complex needs. So, for example, by 2050, we estimate that 1 in 3 people are expected to die with dementia. But they might also have cancer. They might also have heart failure. And I've just sent a tweet out this afternoon, actually, about a 103-year-old lady who cared for her 75-year-old terminally ill son. So there are huge pressures.
I saw that, yes. What a story.
Yeah, huge pressures on the health and social care sector. And, with people living longer, those complex needs and the population growing, obviously demand for our services is only going one direction, and that's up. And those needs are more and more complex. And, of course, it comes at a time when there are huge pressures on the NHS to cope. And actually something we can do, and we provide very good value for money for, is helping people to stay at home and alleviating that burden on the acute hospitals.
Yes, which of course is key, isn't it, really?
Yeah, absolutely.
We want to spend really the rest of the show talking about the strategic HR network that you've developed, because clearly this is a way of saying we may all be facing similar challenges, but we don't have to face them on our own. Let's pool our insight and our experience and our thinking and develop some solutions across the sector that we can all benefit from and that the community we serve can benefit from. So can you tell us a little bit about the strategic HR network then, what it is, what it looks like, and what you're trying to do with it, perhaps in a little bit more detail. You kind of painted a nice context picture there.
Yeah. So I suppose if I was to try and define what a strategic HR network is, I'd probably say it's a way of providing support and intelligence for those in leadership positions who are taking the workforce development, the workforce planning forward in our organisations.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I joined in 2013, which was around the time where Hospice UK, or Help the Hospices as it was then, mm-hmm. were doing some work with the Commission to look at the future of hospice care, what that looked like, and in particular, what the implications were for a future workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally found it quite hard to establish a network when I joined. And I did meet some excellent colleagues from other hospices local to me. But there wasn't really a forum to discuss, you know, the meaty discussion points of, you know, how are we going to find this funding? What are the implications for the workforce? What skills mm-hmm. do we need? How do we get there?
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the challenge we've found since then is that every hospice is very different. There's no consistent model or size.
Right.
So some hospices cater for children, others for adults, some for both, mm-hmm. some have mm-hmm. patient services, some just do community work. Mm-hmm. They vary in size enormously and they vary in structure enormously. There are kind of two aims, really, as I see it, or two challenges, rather. One is looking at the national strategic direction of the workforce to ensure mm-hmm. it's fit for the future and we're planning for it.
Right.
And the other strand is about making sure that we've got the most effective HR capability we can to build and support the workforce at a regional and local level. And we did some really interesting survey work with Hospice UK a couple of years ago, which found that actually only a relatively small proportion of hospices have a senior qualified, by which I mean somebody at director level, representing HR at their board. So mm-hmm. so we're looking at not only what we can do as a sector, so in terms of sharing best practice, gathering intelligence, and scaling up some of that best practice, but also how mm-hmm. we can support each other. So we're looking at some work strands around mentoring and coaching and development. Mm-hmm. So,
hello?
So that's been...
I lost you then.
We've been up and running for about a year or so. Mm-hmm. And what we've tried to do on the HR and workforce side is replicate what already existed for our clinical director colleagues. There was already an established clinical director network nationally, split into regions who meet on a quarterly basis, hold their own annual conference. And really, this is about joining forces. So mm-hmm. our clinical director colleagues have got this huge task upon them of really determining what our future clinical services need to look like in order to mm-hmm. support that growing demand.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that's all part of the same puzzle that I'm looking at, because what stems from that then is, okay, well, if a service needs to look like X, how do we yeah. resource it? What does the skill mix need to look like?
Yes.
How many nurses do we need? How many healthcare assistants do we need? How can we use volunteer skills in supporting that?
So you're looking at a co-responsibility.
It's something that should just sit on the shoulders of our clinical colleagues.
Yeah. So I mean, basically, you're working to say, right, this is, you paint the bigger picture, and you guys, and your strategic HR network actually are saying, right, well, what's the people stream of that look like? How can we make sure that you've got the right people to deliver whatever you've scoped out to be your clinical needs based on your ambition for the sector? Righto.
Yeah.
So you had a model that you were able to draw from and make your own.
We did with the clinical model, as I said, we've tried to replicate that so that actually we've got an HR strategic lead in each region in the way that we have with a clinical lead, and it's not all about reinventing the wheel and coming up with new fantastic ideas. I think what's really apparent to me now is, with 220 or so hospices across England and Scotland and Wales, mm-hmm. there is a huge amount of expertise and knowledge and some fantastic ideas and some fantastic models. So really, you know, I do largely see it as a way to share some of those ideas, scale them up where possible, most hospices are constrained. I think all hospices are constrained in their use of resources. So actually, if we know that something works really well for a similar setup elsewhere, there's no reason why we can't share that and seek to replicate it rather than constantly trying to reinvent the wheel. So that's a big part of what the network does.
Matt, are all of those 220 hospices that you described, are they all involved in your strategic HR network, or only a proportion of them?
They're not. Only a proportion. And I think this is true of whatever strand we're looking at within the sector. I think it's very rare that we get engagement on any one topic or initiative from all 220 or so hospices.
Mm. But are they spread across the country? Do your members come nationally, or are you in a regional? Do you represent a region?
They're all across the country. So the network is called SHUL, which stands for Strategic Hospice and Workforce Leads in palliative. And we have got on that executive group, we have got a regional lead. So the executive group represents the whole of the UK. And each of those regional leads will have a regional network that they go back to and have that two-way communication to feed ideas and models and plans up and down.
Okay. And can you tell us, our listeners, a little bit about some of the particular streams or work streams and strands of work that you're looking at? Because I think that's quite interesting. You've kind of divided things into the sort of areas of thought that really can make a practical difference, I think, haven't you?
Yeah, we have. So one of the strands is around looking at greater collaboration. So as a charity, for those who have read anything in the press in the last 18 months or so around charities, charities have taken a real bashing, and hospices haven't been protected from that. So we're incredibly conscious of the need to demonstrate good value for money, and increasingly there are some models which we're interested in looking at and trying to replicate and scale up, where hospices are working together to share back office functions. So whether that's finance or payroll or HR, but actually even fundraising. So it's possible hospices to retain their own brands locally, because you know, within local communities, hospices are very well known and do quite well with fundraising because of the huge impact on people's lives.
Absolutely.
But actually, you know, what can we do? What can we do to increase the pence in every pound that goes on frontline care and share some of those back office functions? Another strand is looking, I guess, inwardly around what mentoring and coaching solutions can we find for the hospice sector. So that might be for an admin manager who's got HR responsibilities for a hospice in a particular location, and us putting them in touch with an experienced HR director or HR manager who can help them modernise and bring them up to speed. And perhaps even get in to help develop their board or raise awareness at board level of the value of a strategic HR partner. So the big ticket item for me, which we're still trying to address really, is the $1 million question of what do those future services look like, and what resource do we need to staff those up. I think we are starting to get there now, and certainly at Ashgate Hospice Care, I've talked a little bit about our big ambition. So our growth isn't going to be in the number of inpatient unit beds. It's about the community services. What's really interesting is when we look at the education and development side of things as well. So we know already that there's a huge shortage of nurses in the UK, and again, fairly common knowledge that, I think.
Yes.
We also know that the nursing bursary has been removed. So actually, you could argue, and I would argue, that that's a bit of a disincentive for people to want to start a career in nursing. However, with the advent of things like the apprenticeship levy, more and more hospices, and ours is no exception to this, are looking at those vocational routes into training. And actually, we're doing a big push for developing our own career pathways and you know, seeking to kind of grow and manage our own talent. Maybe, you know, recruit healthcare assistants or nurses in training, support them to learn whilst they work, and develop our workforce of the future that way. Because I think the days of going out to advert and seeking specialist palliative care nurses are drying up, really. We've also got an ageing workforce, so we have got some real challenges when we think about that future workforce, and we need to start now, really. It's not too late yet, but we need to start now. In terms
and of course,
of,
there's the uncertainty of European workers as well. I guess that's another big question mark. Isn't it over? Yeah,
it's interesting, actually.
Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, you know, absolutely, and you know, as we know, that's that saga continues, and is really an unknown in terms of the impact. But what we do know is that, anecdotally, EU nursing applications are down considerably following the referendum. So again, you know, when you look at the huge intake of nurses that the NHS and therefore our healthcare sector took from places like Portugal in recent years, Brexit, you know, might well mean that dries up as well. So we've really got to start now on developing our own. What we can't do is wait until we have our defined models of what the future service looks like, because if we do that, it's going to be too late.
It'll
our experienced nurses will have retired, and we're going to have a gap of 4 years whilst we train up our own nurses to fill those roles. So
it's very interesting what you're talking about, Matt. I had a guest on the show about a month ago, actually, who's managing director of a chain of care homes. So not the same, obviously, but just, you know, slightly an allied sector. And he was talking about what they've done in terms of career paths for their people, and how a few years ago all of the management roles were advertised and recruited for, and people would come in to work in a care home as managers and manage the care workers. And so the care workers had no obvious career path. You know, they came in as a care assistant and stayed as a care assistant. They had nowhere to go. So they've introduced these career paths to actually encourage their people who are coming in as care assistants to actually see that there is a path there that they can apply for and grow and develop.
Yeah.
And now their management level people are actually their own people, and they're no longer seeing outsiders coming in and taking those roles. And it's had an enormous impact on their employee engagement levels.
And I think it's really important in the current labour market as well. You know, unemployment in the UK is at the lowest it's been for 40 odd years. It's relatively easy to find another job. You know, we've got to make it attractive. There's got to be an attractive proposition for people to come and join our organisations. They are fantastic places to work. I think one of the big challenges for us, actually, is because unlike an acute hospital, so your local big NHS hospital that, you know, where you go to if you've got a broken leg, everyone's been to. We've all been there to visit relatives or to have your, you know, plaster cast on your arm or whatever it might be. Hospices aren't like that. So as I said, you know, I'm 43 years old now, and until 2013, I'd never stepped foot in a hospice. I had no idea really what the working environment was like. Culture was like, never mind what the services were. And what we find actually is our turnover is really low, because typically once people come and join us, they don't want to go because the culture is so fantastic. And whilst we work hard, I like to think we play hard as well. You know, it is hard work, and particularly in terms of kind of emotional toll and resilience, and we do a lot of work supporting our staff and volunteers with resilience. So we run things like Schwartz rounds, which I guess there's not time to go into detail here, but if you Google Schwartz rounds, that will tell you what you need to know. But it's that wraparound care, not just for patients, but for our staff as well and volunteers, that I think makes a real difference working
in hospice. Interesting you mentioned volunteers. I was going to ask you about that. I mean, what roughly, because I'm aware, again, as I said, of the hospice near where I live, they have a lot of volunteers, a lot of people do deliver those services in a voluntary capacity. I mean, what proportion, how important are they to your workforce?
They are vital, and I think every hospice would say the same thing, which is we simply could not offer the services we offer without the volunteer input we have. So at Ashgate Hospice Care, we have more than doubled our numbers of volunteers in the last 4 years, and we've got about 60 or 70 different roles that they undertake, everything from fundraising to sitting with our patients and helping them on our inpatient unit. I've tried to calculate the financial cost of that, so to put some pound signs against it, and a conservative estimate would put it at more than £500,000 a year if we had to pay the volunteers for that time. So we're looking at nearly 800 volunteers here, and we just couldn't do what we do without them there.
And I guess that forms part of that big ticket point you were talking about in terms of the workforce, because there is certainly a sense, isn't there, that people are not as willing to volunteer as they once were. Local community, scouts and guides, teams and football, they struggle to get people to help them in a way they once did. And is that something that you're seeing? I mean, you were saying you've actually increased the number of your volunteers, so I'm guessing
One of the challenges, I mean, particularly around voluntary funding, so fundraising, is the increasing ask from charities. But actually with volunteering, I think particularly for hospices, end of life comes to us all. I hate to break it to you, but we all die at some point.
Death and taxes, the only certainties in the world,
So the hospice touches a lot of people in the community, and often we find it's people who have been affected through a relative or a friend who's been cared for by the hospice that want to come back and give something back. So it does work well. We've got to be mindful of the volunteer experience and make sure that we give them what they want, and we support them and care for them in the way that we do for our staff as well. But again, as I said before, I feel quite privileged to work here because nobody here, volunteer or member of staff, has a 9-to-5 attitude. People give it their all, and they care passionately about what they do, which is great.
Which is great, isn't it? Okay, Matt, we've only got a few minutes left now. Just in the last 3 minutes we've got, I just want to turn to ask you, you've talked about what you're trying to do with the network and how you are, the reasons why it came about. Are there any immediate wins that you're pointing to? I mean, you've talked about the big ticket item, and clearly there's some real time pressure to get some answers to those issues about how you resource those future services. But so far, what are you seeing as the sort of successes you can point to? And also, on the other hand, what remains still to, what remains to be done?
So I think we are better at sharing good practice now. And I think there are ideas and models that have been shared that I think wouldn't necessarily have been shared before. I think at a regional level, that might just be something as simple as policy development. But what the network has done is has got people connected and talking to each other. So I think undoubtedly we've saved resource already in that respect. We are making progress in terms of the big ticket items, the strategic workforce planning side of things, and we're working at the moment with a couple of software developers actually who have got a product already that they're bringing to market. But what we're doing is acting as a stakeholder really to give them feedback and to help them develop something that hospices in turn can use to remodel services in a kind of safe virtual way.
So
hopefully we'll see some development from that in the near future.
The other
thing I would point to is probably the mentoring and coaching. So for a lot of people with HR responsibility or workforce planning responsibility who have maybe felt isolated before, this gives people a forum. We've got hosted through Hospice UK, which is a national membership body now, something called Hospice IQ, which is a kind of digital interaction chat forum, social media forum, if you like, where people can ask questions and get responses, and we can put people in touch for mentoring and coaching development as well. So,
excellent. And if people want to get involved with your strategic HR network, are there opportunities for them to do that? Just in the last sort of 20 seconds or so of the show, that we can touch on that.
Yep, if you go to the Hospice UK website, so if you just Google Hospice UK or just Google Hospice UK Shawl, S-H-A-W-L, mm-hmm. that will take mm-hmm. you straight into the Shawl web pages, and that will give you a list of all the executive members with their email addresses. If you drop any of us a line, we'll be more than happy to talk to you. If you're outside the sector, we'll still be more than happy to talk to you. I would like to see collaboration eventually wider than just the hospice sector. You talked about care homes earlier. We do a lot of work with educating care homes around end-of-life care, mm-hmm. so I'm sure there's more collaboration to do there in the future as well.
Lovely. And that's us done. So thank you very much for joining us, Matt, and thank you, everybody, for listening. It just remains for me to say goodbye and say goodbye to you, Matt. So thank you.
Lovely. Thanks for having me, Jo. Thanks.
It's been a pleasure.
Cheers.
Engage for Success Radio, raising the profile of employee engagement and shining a light on good practice for people who believe there's a better way to work.